This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Hanan Khalifa and Dr. Karen Ashton to speak to us today. They work in the Research and Validation Division at Cambridge ESOL, and as you can see, they're going to be talking about research and impact in an educational assessment context.
Thank you, Sarah. I guess I'm not Karen, I'm Hanan, just in case. When we were preparing this presentation, we were thinking with language assessment as the background, but also throughout the discussion, what we will bring in is our previous and current experiences with educational reform projects, both Karen and I. So please feel free at any point in the presentation to ask us clarification questions or any questions that come up. We're also hoping that it will not be a one-way present delivery, so there will be some tasks that we will be asking you to do. This afternoon, we will start by discussing the growing influence of tests and the power that tests exert on different stakeholders. We'll move on to discuss how Cambridge ESOL, or actually the language testing field, differentiates between two terms, washback and impact. We'll move on to talk a little bit more about how learning and assessment are now really merging together. Learning-oriented assessment is becoming a new term and a new new theories are being put forward with regards to learning-oriented assessment. Then we will focus on Cambridge ESOL's model of impact by design. We'll talk a little bit more about it. We will end up by sharing with you some case studies where we have conducted impact studies. Hope this is okay. Okay. To start with, a common perception about tests. This quotation comes from a known language tester, Ilana Shohami, who is very active in terms of trying to convince stakeholders and decision makers in certain parts of the world how tests exert power and why testing organizations should really be very accountable and why decision makers need to be so accountable before they make a decision about a certain exam and about the decisions based on that assessment. So Ilana mentioned, tests exert a powerful influence on educational processes and on society more broadly. Most importantly, we need to think about how we use test data. Multiple functions. It is personal achievement, exam results as proof of individual achievement. So that's one use of test data. Another use, providing diagnostic information, feedback to learners and teachers, and that will impact on the learning and the teaching process. But what it is really used for, or most commonly used for, is the next bullet point, public accountability. Evidence of meeting targets, especially if you are a Ministry of Education and you've got a donor funding, whether it's the World Bank or any other funding agency, they will have milestones. They will have key performance indicators where they will tell you, show me the results. And one way of doing so is exam results. Exam results as proof of value for money. If I'm an independent school who would like to offer an international qualification, I need to make sure that this international qualification is worth the money that my students are paying for and the parents are paying for. Usefulness of scheme and program. Again, this goes back to whether the initiatives that are taken are delivering what they're supposed to be delivering. So what are the implications for a language testing body? Test purpose must be clearly defined and understood. So when we embark on designing an assessment, we really, as test developers, we really have to be very clear in our heads, why are we assessing? How will the data be used? What kind of decisions will be made based on that data? our approach must be fit for purpose. So, for example, if we want to develop an exam for call center employees, where we want to see whether they pronounce clearly and intelligibly, should I do, would a face-to-face speaking exam be better, or can I do reading aloud? There must be an appropriate balance of essential test qualities. Colleagues here from ESOL would be very familiar with the acronym of VRIP and with our principles of good practice, the four essential test qualities that Cambridge ESOL has been talking about for at least a decade: validity, reliability, impact, practicality, and quality. VRIP-Q. The principles of good practice is available to download free from our website. If you'd like to know a little bit more about our VRIP-Q, please feel free to download. I would like to share with you this this video clip. Are you familiar with the Gaokao exam in China? Right? Gu, you do not speak now. Okay, you speak later. Right, this video clip was put out on a language testing site by Glenn Fulcher, and we would like to share this with you. While you're watching, please ask yourselves, what do you think the authorities are so concerned with correct procedures and noise reduction? What do you think of students marking their own tests to predict university entrance potential? We'll come back to this.
It's the morning of Gaokao. 10 million students across China will sit four papers over two boiling hot days in June. For families in Xiamen County, a good result in the Gaokao can mean the difference between poverty and prosperity. Throughout the country, building sites are closed down, flight paths redirected, and every school has its own police guard. Ensuring that each class gets the correct papers is meticulously regimented. Despite all the preparations, things are not going to plan. Students take their seats in the exam room. There's one who's cutting it a bit fine. The students have to be seated a full half hour before the exam begins to listen to the strict rules and regulations that must be observed to the letter. For the duration of the exams, many parents wait outside in the searing heat for their children's safe return. With one exam down, the students have a couple of hours off to eat and rest before the next one begins.
But,
The Gaokao exam has only existed in its current high-pressure form since 1977. The 2 days of grueling Gaokao exams are almost over. The English paper is the fourth and final hurdle.
How much are these shoes?
Oh, they are $35 a pair.
Do you have size 9?
I'm afraid they are sold out.
Weren't enough, the Gaokao students have to return to school the next morning to be given the correct answers to their exams and calculate an estimated score. The marks they calculate here will be used by the school to begin the process of applying for university. Almost everyone's turned up to perform this arduous task. For some, seeing the answers is cause for cautious optimism, but for others, it only increases their worries about their final result. It's the 24th of June, and the day 10 million students across China have been waiting for. Today, the Gaokao results will be published simultaneously, and students sit poised to receive their marks either by phone or online.
I did not grow up in the UK, and I cannot say anything about the educational system here, really. But what I was seeing as a viewer is that how much parents are involved with the exams, and how much the mothers that go with the kids to the exam session, and they wait outside, and they sort of revise with them. I don't know whether that is something that is good or bad, whether it's something similar to what happens here or not. I don't know. To me, it's just how much parents are involved in sharing the responsibility of the learning with their kids, or whether the kids are independent enough, whether that's a good or a bad thing. It's really a question to you, please. Thinking about your own context and the impact of high-stakes testing, what issues are there? Is there a way to address or avoid negative effects before they occur? I'm not going to ask you to answer this because I need to move on. I would usually use that, Karen, myself, and Angeliki as well. We'd usually use that when we have multiple different countries in the audience. So we'll move on, and if there's time, we can come back. Okay, I'm handing over to Karen.
Great, thank you. I'm sorry to take you away from that because that was really interesting, and what we're looking at now will still be interesting, but maybe not quite as engaging. We're going to now look at these two terms, washback and impact, which are commonly used interchangeably. We're just going to explain how we see the difference between these two terms and how we use them. First of all, I need an example of an impact in a classroom. So if we look at the example that we just saw in the video, what could a potential positive or negative impact of that assessment style be on a learner in the classroom?
If you post multiple choice answers, then it becomes an issue of being able to recognise the correct answer as opposed to being able to generate it.
Right.
So if you're looking at people's ability to speak a language,
mm-hmm.
Well, it may help, particularly with the listening,
right.
Distinguishing, you're not testing their ability to create the sentence on a blank page, as well.
Right, and how might their impact on that learner in the classroom and what's going on in the classroom.
What you teach them to recognise, not to create.
So they're not able to produce language in the same way. Yeah. Let's use that example when we're looking at this model of washback. So this has different dimensions. So the first one is specificity, if I can say that. How specific is the effect produced by the test? So if we looked at that example, you'd be looking at how specific is that? How strong is that within... how specific is that effect in the classroom? And the next one looks at intensity, so how strong is the effect? So in the example you've given us, that might be quite narrow, for example, so it might not have such a strong effect, or it might have a huge effect on everything the learner's doing. So that would depend on, we'd have to know more about that situation. The third one, length. How long will the effect last? Obviously, if you're in the school system, some of these impacts can last quite a long time because they're embedded in the school system. Is the effect intentional? It might be that a lot of the impacts that we've seen in this Chinese example weren't actually intended, but most of them might be, or the majority of them might be, for practical reasons rather than elements actually intended by the test developers. So, for example, what we were just talking about with the listening test element being removed, the impact probably wasn't intentional, however, it's for a practical or potentially political reason. And the next one, value. How is the effect perceived by key stakeholders? So it could be, if we look at your example again, if, for example, employers really need people to be able to produce language in the workplace, that impact could be perceived quite negatively by other stakeholders. Okay, so that's a bit about washback. Now we're going to look at the differences between washback and impact. So for washback, or sometimes you might hear also backwash, it's been broadly defined as the effect on teaching and learning. Whereas impact concerns the effects and consequences more broadly than that. It goes beyond the immediate classroom context. So we would say washback is really related to the micro context of the classroom and the school, whereas impact deals with the macro context and impacts on society more broadly. Just to give you an example of that, so we'd say, of course, that a test can have an impact on the classroom or the immediate learning environment, so that kind of washback effect, but also a test can impact much more broadly, so it can impact on an individual, their career and their life chances, and in education systems and in society more broadly. And we're going to pick up on some of those elements a little bit later. But now I want to look at this kind of continuum of positive and negative impacts. When we talk about impacts, as with anything, we tend to categorise them into positive and negative things. So we had this example earlier, I think from you were saying a test can impact on the curriculum. Would you see that as a positive or a negative impact? Where would you place that along this continuum? Now we've put, like you, we've put this with a question mark because these are quite subjective and it depends on how you look at it, but we've put these elements as potential positive impacts of a test. A test can potentially increase the motivation of learners. Of course, it can increase the proficiency of learners in their preparation for the test. And if assessment's done correctly, it can narrow the relationship between learning and assessment. Some things that we've put as potentially negative things: restriction of the content, narrowing of the curriculum. If people are studying towards the test, and then that has a feedback loop on what's taught in the classroom, that could narrow it. Also, too much time practicing for the test. Does that take away the time for learners to be doing other activities? But we've put question marks there because as you've identified, that is subjective and it does depend on the stakeholder and also what particularly you're looking at. And just to look at that, this concept of teaching to the test, is it really a negative impact? We have one person here saying, it's frequently been noted that teachers will teach to a test. That is, if they know the content of a test and or the format of a test, they will teach their students accordingly. I'm sure that's something that you can all identify with. And then we have this other quote which says, it's true that teachers teach to an examination. Officials have three choices. They can fight it, ignore it, or use it. I want to look at a couple of examples now using tests for a purpose for which they weren't intended. So we all know that you can develop a test. You set out your test. You state what the purpose is. You say that very clearly. The test is being used for that purpose. And then suddenly, a stakeholder might come along that uses your test for a different purpose. So I've got two examples here. I'm sure you might have some others. But the first example is for young learner tests. So young learner tests are clearly not designed to be particularly high stakes. They're designed to assess proficiency, but to be easy for learners to engage with. What happens if a stakeholder decides to use your young learner test for a much higher stakes purpose and to take decisions based on that which weren't really in your mind when you developed the test? The second example, which is something very interesting for us, what happens when your test is used as a criteria for entry in terms of something like immigration? And that's something that language testers are having to deal with. That's not the purpose for which our tests were developed, but that's a new use that's being made of them. So now, just to quickly mention that cause and effect explanations are really adequate because assessments form part of very complex systems. So it's very easy for us to look at impacts, but you have to assess them very carefully because they are part of a much broader system. Questions that we think we need to consider: how can educators and assessment providers foster beneficial effects from their tests and examinations? And how can harmful consequences be avoided or their impact mitigated? Things that we think are important are fostering a closer relationship between learning and assessment, therefore having a more sort of learning-oriented assessment approach. And then by understanding as well that tests do have unintended consequences, so following an impact by design approach, which Hanan is going to introduce to you. So being aware, basically, that your tests are out there, they can have an impact, and let's try and narrow that gap between learning and assessment. So just to look at that, a closer relationship between learning and assessment. For us, we think it's important, obviously, to have provision of effective feedback to pupils, active involvement of pupils in their own learning, adjusting teaching to take account of the results of assessment, and recognition of the influence that assessment has on the motivation and self-esteem of pupils, and the need for pupils to assess themselves and understand how to improve, so learning how to self-assess their ability. And we'll look at some of those elements later when we're looking at a couple of the examples of case studies that we've done for impact, because those are elements that we take into account. I'm sure this must be familiar to most of you. Does everybody know Vygotsky in the zone of proximal development? I think most people are probably very familiar, maybe more familiar than me with this. But this is something we like to look at to conceive of how learning and assessment fit together. Basically, on this side here, this is talking about the level of a task. And here you're talking about how much support a learner gets. So obviously in the classroom, a learner can achieve more if they're supported. They can achieve at a higher level than they would if they're not supported. And so what we have here is the zone of proximal development. And everything here is too hard for the learner. So actually, you're not going to get a good result if you push the learner too hard. And everything here is too easy for the learner. And again, you're not going to achieve as well as you could. So the idea is that you should be operating in this area there. And that's just a model that we like to use to look at how it could fit together. I think I'm handing back to you now, Hanan.
Okay, back in 1996, Mike Milanovic and Nick Saville developed put together an impact by design model, which is basically an action-oriented approach towards impact. It has four maxims. The first one is about planning, using a rational and explicit approach to test development. This is where we have a clear vision of what tests we want to develop, for whom, what is the purpose of that test, how the data is going to be used, or how we intend the data to be used. Of course, whether that intention materializes or not is something a little bit outside our control. The second maxim is that we support stakeholders in the testing process. Who are the stakeholders? Are you a stakeholder? Do we have any parents in this room? Yes? So you are a stakeholder as a parent, right? Do we have ex-teachers in this room? So you used to be an ex-stakeholder as a teacher. Do we have learners in this room? Again, you're a stakeholder. Do we have test providers in this room? I want to hear a collective yes. Okay. Yes, so we have loads of stakeholders that we need to engage in a process of communication with them and also to support them. And when we say support, so how can we support our teachers? How can we support the learners? How could we support the centers who provide our examinations? In Cambridge ESOL, for example, there is a website for teachers. There are lots of materials for candidates. There's a whole division, I think at least 40 people within Cambridge ESOL working with centers, supporting them in test administration, training them, etc. Communicating. We've mentioned earlier that we need to communicate about the purpose of the test, about the data, so provide comprehensive, useful, and transparent information. How do we do that? We either do it I'm not familiar with CIE and OCR, but I know that, for example, for Cambridge ESOL, we do that either through publications, through our quarterly journal research notes, through our leaflets that goes to centers, to the different stakeholders, what we put on the test report forms for candidates, on the certificates, etc. We have a help desk to respond to queries. The last maxim is monitor and evaluate. So collect all the relevant data and analyze it. And the reason that we say monitor and evaluate because we see the whole process as iterative and cyclical. I'm going to skip a few slides because I've talked about them. Okay, monitoring impact in educational assessment projects. They need to see assessment projects as educational innovations and to manage change effectively. In lots of talks that we right now are engaged with ministries of education, they come to us and say, we are introducing this new initiative. We want to test our 5-year-olds and our 7-year-olds. We only want to test them in listening and reading. We do not really care about speaking. And we think that by the time they reach 11 or 12, they would be fluent. Is that a realistic expectation? Should we sit and talk to them and sort of manage their expectations? What is our role as a testing provider? In our discussions with them, we start talking about establishing where they are, so establishing a baseline or carrying out benchmarking studies, determining where they want to go, where they want to be in 10 years' time or in 20 years' time or in 5 years' time, and then evaluating how we get there together. And as I said, we see that the learning environment is a dynamic environment. That's why the whole process of impact has to be cyclical and not linear. Introducing a program, making changes or setting new goals, we monitor and evaluate how well that went. We make new changes, we set new goals, monitor and evaluate, and so on and so forth. Some of the general impact questions that we use is your educational reform program delivering what you expected when you initiated it? Of course, this is a discussion or a question that is addressed towards decision makers, addressed towards a minister of education or a deputy minister or key decision makers in the hierarchy. What is the impact of your test or assessment program on learners? And we subdivide that. One question could be, are learners more motivated and has their ability improved as a result of the program? Another one looks at teachers. What is the impact on teachers? In what ways has the test or program positively impacted on teacher motivation, teaching practice, teaching materials, and curriculum? On the next slide, these are sample impact constructs that we look at. We try and define what we mean by learner motivation. We try and define what we mean by teaching practice. If we're looking at parents' involvement, what does that actually mean? What are the perceptions of decision makers of the intended impact? The way that we conduct impact studies is that we use several instruments, interviews, focus groups, observations, questionnaires, document review, curriculum review. Okay, thank you. Over to you, Karen.
Thanks. Great. We're now going to introduce you into some of the case studies that we've been doing. The first one I'm actually not going to talk about because of time, but just to let you know, we did a case study with the Ministry of Education in Italy called the Progetto Lingua 2000. If any of you are interested in learning more about that, there is a whole SILT volume you can see at the bottom there, Studies in Language Testing 24, which you can refer to on that. I'm going to introduce you to what's known as the Better Impact Project, which is a project that I've been doing and now will be Angeliki's responsibility in Spain. It's a project we've been doing with the Autonomous Community of Madrid, working with their religious schools there, so with their Catholic schools in Madrid. They have a program called the Better Program, which is designed to implement bilingual education through its schools in the Madrid community. It has set quite ambitious targets. It would like to achieve the Common European Framework level of B2, which is quite an advanced level of English, by the time its learners leave secondary school. There's three key components to the program. So one is the assessment for students, which is provided by Cambridge ESOL. However, there are also assessment possibilities for teachers as well. The second key component is a teacher training program, and the provision of course books. That's not provided by us. And then this third one, which is called bilingual ethos, and that means different things to different schools. Some of them have a bilingual corner or some bilingual signs around the school, but they have to do something that shows a bilingual ethos, and you can imagine that's open to interpretation. The other interesting thing with this program is that it has kind of a tiered participation. So any school can join what's called the general participation, and then schools have to show evidence of meeting certain criteria to go up the tiers. And there's a general level and then three further tiers. And at this very top level, there are only two schools at that level at the moment. And schools have to show evidence of certain criteria. So one is learning hours of English, one is results, one's related to their teacher curriculum, how many extracurricular activities they have, and then a panel of people evaluate that and decide where they sit. The project that I've been doing is working with four schools who belong to the Better Programme and schools that are at different tiers of the programme. Obviously, it's very small scale, and we've just been doing what we call phase one, so the first year of the project. It's an ongoing project, and Angeliki is actually taking it over, and it will become a much larger scale project. But what we're looking at here is just the results from the early feedback from the four schools. So we were looking at these kinds of areas, learner motivation, proficiency, the perceptions and attitudes of different stakeholders. And we were looking there at FEDE, which is the organisation in Madrid who set up the Better Programme. We were looking at learners, teachers, and also parents. and teacher motivations and teaching practice. The design we had initially, I did a selection of interviews with FERE, the organisation who set up the programme, and then with what's called the BEDA coordinator, so that's the lead teacher within each of the schools who's responsible for the programme. And then questionnaires were administered over the internet to, over an internet-based programme to students, teachers and parents. And I'm just going to show you now sort of some of the highlights of some of the results, which are presented in a very qualitative way. First of all, we were looking at why schools wanted to join this programme, because they didn't have to join. It was actually up to them to decide they want to join. So what were their motivations? One thing we found for schools who were much newer to the programme, they were very worried about falling behind in bilingual education and in learning English. So they wanted to keep up with other schools. And then visibility. This was quite an interesting one. I had a couple of schools who were in the programme for a lot longer and had actually been using our exams for 5 or 6 years say that language learning isn't visible to parents. Parents can't really see this, their daughters or sons progress very quickly. And so belonging to the BEDA programme gave visibility to what the school was doing to improve English, because they were finding they were talking to parents and saying, we're doing all of these things to try and promote English, and parents just didn't recognise it all because they couldn't see it. So something as simple as that, and joining the programme enabled them to have this kind of sign or placard in front of the school. So that was actually quite a motivating reason for some of these schools. And external reference, so the fact that they could actually say, Cambridge ESOL is saying that you're good or bad at English rather than the teachers, was something that they really appreciated as well. So they could have some distance from the process. Okay, the impact of tests, first of all, on learners. So one thing we found for students who'd been using, or for schools who'd been using the tests for a longer period, so say 5, 6 years, they'd noticed a huge difference in student awareness of their own abilities and their ability to self-assess themselves. So, for example, a teacher said that now students come to her and say things like this, I got a bad mark in listening, what can I do about it? And she said that now students can see problems and want to resolve them. That's something that didn't happen 5, 6 years ago. So that's a very interesting impact. Something similar for the teachers. Teachers have said doing the test was a good evaluation, so good feedback. It's also helped them to establish what their students are good or bad at. So they've said, well, we realise that actually our learners weren't very good at writing, so we have to put more effort into writing. But the speaking was okay. And we've changed what we're doing with speaking to make it match the exam. We have a lot more communication activities now. So hopefully that's a good impact that the exam's having. As I mentioned, this thing of visibility I found quite interesting, the fact that the placard is something visual to illustrate that the school's doing something. What they did mention, though, as challenges for the future, as I mentioned, there's this tiered system, and obviously schools hope to go from one tier to the next tier. They mentioned that it's very stressful to implement that change within the school, because as you're moving from one tier to the next tier, you have to show evidence of doing more things, and how you can actually implement that across the school was something quite stressful for schools. They also mentioned that they're supposed to be doing CLIL, they're supposed to be teaching through the medium of English, but no one really understood what that meant, and no one really understood how they should actually do that. So you'd see one school who was doing science through the medium of English, another one was doing swimming lessons through the medium of English, and one doing art and primary school through the medium of English. And everyone here was trying their very best, but they felt that they needed a lot more support across schools, really. So this idea that currently schools were kind of on their own, making their own way, and actually they would really like some sort of social media or something for teachers to be able to communicate with each other, to sheer ideas. So that's just a very quick introduction into the project that I've been doing. And as I said, that was just with four schools. The next cycle of this project is much larger scale with a larger number of schools. And so we'll be able to have a lot more data in the next round. I think I'm handing to Hanan now for to talk about her project briefly.
I promise I'll finish in 2 minutes. So I'll do this very quickly. Moving to a different part of the world, in Abu Dhabi, the Abu Dhabi Educational Council, part of their 10-year strategy is to offer bilingual education to the state schools. Now, state schools in Abu Dhabi cover rural and urban areas, areas where parents could take away their kids and say, you're going to go camel or goat herding, or it's the camel racing season, you're not going to go to school. You go to one class where you find the age group in grade 4 ranging between 8 and 12. And what ADEC wanted to do is they wanted to introduce bilingual education from kindergarten. And they wanted to know whether the provision of a bilingual program has a negative or a positive impact, especially on national identity, and whether that will lead to the kids losing Arabic. And I think that was a political decision why they wanted to do an impact study. So they called on ESOL, and lucky me, I had to go there and go around the schools, which was quite interesting, where they thought that I'm Italian. So they kept talking to me in English for some odd reason. The model of bilingual education that they were following there is that some of the subjects were taught in English, like the science and the maths, and other subjects like history and geography were taught in Arabic. Of course, religion, Islamic studies is in Arabic. There's an Arabic language. There's also an English language class. When you go inside the classroom for the maths and science, it varied from one grade to the other whether the teacher was using actually just the terminology and the rest of interaction was in Arabic. So it was Arabic, and then you hear a term, a biological term, or a chemistry term, or it was all in English. I have used loads of the instruments that we have talked about earlier, and a variety of them. When we also did questionnaires with parents, quite a high percentage of parents were illiterate. So that's where it was quite resource draining that the teachers had to sit with the parents in a parents' meeting and ask the question and note down the responses. However, most of the parental response was quite positive, and this is one of them. Learning English doesn't affect my son's Arabic language. Both are different subjects. The Arabic teacher focuses on improving the Arabic language in her class, and the same is true for the English teacher. You can imagine it was only mums who participated in the study rather than the dads. On culture and heritage, one of the things that the Emiratis were very, very keen on finding out, if we give them English, does that affect their national identity and heritage? And you need also to understand that in the Emirates, you could have the parents speaking in Arabic, but you have the house help speaking in Urdu or in Punjabi or in Thai. So it's a different language. And these were some of the typical comments. I think learning any foreign language makes the person more confident and doesn't affect his own identity or heritage, but he must keep reading and learning his own language. To me, those of them said so. We also looked back at the questionnaires and how much the parents were involved in the learning of their kids. And I think that was typical of those who were where parental involvement was quite high. Another one, it doesn't matter which language I speak, it will never weaken my national identity. You could imagine that when ADEC heard this, they were very, very happy. We speak only Arabic at home. We maintain our national identity, our habits and tradition. We can transfer these to our children. English is only at school. Actually, as a result of the impact study that was done, what they have done is that they have introduced what they called licensed teachers in KG. These are native speakers of English. They could be anybody who actually speaks good English rather than being New Zealand or Australian or South African or British or American. I could be an Egyptian, but they call them licensed teachers. But also, they provided the licensed teachers with 3 months cultural orientation so that if they want to use any hand gestures or any facial gestures, that also is quite familiar to the kids. Okay, we reached the end of the seminars, but we are open to questions if you want, or you can dash home. Up to you.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.